You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking to American League East with MLB.com's AL East beat reporters. We'll be talking about the changes in the front office that didn't happen and might be coming in Toronto. We'll be talking about the outfield in Baltimore. We'll be talking about the rotation in Boston. We'll be talking about all of the various intrigue that they're trying to put together another winning club with the Rays, and we'll be looking ahead to how the Yankees build what they hope will be another division champion. Thanks, everybody, for listening to MLB.com Extras, talking Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles beat reporter, Brittany Giroli. Britt, it seems like the biggest ongoing news with the Orioles is two guys who are already on the roster. We keep asking the question, but you got a little more info on Matt Wieters and Manny Machado this weekend. What's your understanding as to how those guys are progressing as spring training gets close?
Well, Manny Machado is going to be a full go pretty much from day one of spring training. He said over the weekend he's done everything. That includes running laterally, moving side to side, fielding ground balls, hitting, running the bases, all of that stuff. So he seemed fairly confident that he would be a regular player, as did manager Buck Showalter, from day one. Now, Matt Wieters is a more interesting case, coming off of Tommy John surgery. Right now, he's building that arm back up to throw on flat ground, but I would imagine early on in camp, he won't be catching a lot of games. They'll find other ways for him to get work. He could catch bullpens, obviously not be able to limit kind of that throwing back to the pitcher, but he can use that extra time. He can bat. He doesn't have any issue hitting from either side of the plate, but I do think they're going to slow play him with the hope that he would be ready on opening day. Right now, if everything goes according to plan, he would be ready. It would put him in line to start the opener against Tampa Bay. But a lot can go on between then and now. They're trying to stay out in front of it. So far, he's hit every test that they've given him. He seemed fairly optimistic as well.
It's been a little while, but since the last time we talked, it looks like maybe the Orioles finally got their corner bat. How do they view Travis Snyder? Is he an everyday kind of hard to line up kind of bat, or is he a complimentary piece? What do they think they've gotten in him?
Well, I think right now they've got a lot of guys who they're not sure how it's going to play out. When you look at that corner outfield spots, you've got Diaza, you've got Delmon Young, you've got David Lowe, you've got Travis Snyder, you've got Steve Pierce. You've certainly got a bunch of guys, and don't forget Ariel Alvarez is a guy that they like a lot in the minors, who they don't think is very far off. So I don't think that they have certain roles for those guys yet. I think a lot of it's going to come down to camp, how these guys look. You're going to see a lot of matchups, a lot of platooning by manager Buck Showalter to see where they fit in. But they liked the fact that Snyder is under team control for another year beyond this one. They liked the power bat. They like how he fit in and projects to fit in at Camden Yards. So they were very happy to get a guy like him. Defense is good. They're a very strong defensive club, and they didn't want to have a liability out there in the outfield. So I'm not sure where exactly he fits in, if he's that everyday guy just yet, but he's a guy who really seems to have put it together in the second half of last season. They feel like he might be poised for a breakout year.
Are they still looking for another corner bat, or does he sort of fit what they were trying to accomplish in that regard?
I think he fits what they're trying to accomplish. I think right now they probably need another utility player in the infield, and another reliever or two to go to camp just to foster some more competition. So, you know, they never really replaced Andrew Miller, and there's really no place on the open market where you could say, oh, this would be another Andrew Miller. Obviously, he was exceptional, but I think they want a little bit more depth in that relief category heading into spring training. And again, like I mentioned, I think they want another infielder, a guy who can kind of play two or three positions.
Do you think, and it doesn't seem to be a fit, but you kind of have to ask at this point, as a guy's price comes down, you wonder if more and more people get him play. Do you think that there's any potential fit on a James Shields addition for the Orioles, as it seems maybe he's getting close to landing somewhere?
Now, I got asked about this morning on the radio, too, and you know, it's funny. It seems like, yeah, the longer he hangs around, the more it becomes a possibility for the Orioles. I haven't heard his name mentioned in any circles in the organization. But similar to Nelson Cruz, who you really didn't hear too much about with the Orioles, if something falls into their lap, would they listen? Absolutely. They do have money to spend. Not re-signing Nelson Cruz and Nick Markakis makes it possible for them to make moves in spring training and, you know, before camp breaks and things like that. But they have six starters right now for five spots. And while James Shields would certainly be an upgrade, I just don't see them getting heavily involved in what happens with him. Now, could that change? Absolutely. But right now, I don't see it happening for them. I don't think they're a real premier destination for him, although he would be a good fit. I covered him personally in Tampa in 2008. He's a great clubhouse guy, a guy who really goes out there and eats innings, which is something they've lacked in the past. But they haven't really been a team that's pursued any kind of starting upgrades this winter. I don't see how that changes now.
Are they in a position, you seem to hit on this, whether it's free agency, whether it's a trade, whether it's even a trade at the deadline, is it accurate to say they at least are in a position where they could take on some payroll, whoever it was, if they found a guy they like, that they could add some money to their payroll?
Oh, sure. And Buck and Dan Duquette mentioned it several times this weekend at FanFest. They did not reallocate those resources, really, that they lost with Markakis and Cruz. And they do have a lot of arbitration-eligible players, so that, of course, is going to make that payroll go up no matter what. But they have room to play with, and there are things that they can do. And I think they both know and understand that the teams aren't built solely in the winter. You look at what they did this time a year ago, and no one was too excited, yet they managed to make it to the ALCS. So they know there are moves that can make this team better that haven't been made yet. And like you said, the trade deadline, even the end of spring training. I mean, this is a club that's really in the driver's seat, I think, when you look at in terms of having that payroll flexibility that they have right now. And really, they haven't made any major moves. So if the move is there, if something comes up, they're not really restricted by anything financially.
You had a piece recently on Jonathan Scope, who was a very well-regarded prospect coming up and had a little bit of a tough year at the plate at times last year, but guy they clearly like quite a bit, and kind of addressing him as potentially a interesting breakout candidate. What do you think is reasonable to expect of him in 2015 as a guy entering his second full season?
Well, I think he's learned a lot, and he's a guy who really kind of dedicated himself this winter to slimming down. His speed was a little bit of an issue at times defensively and running the bases, so he hopes to be about 10 pounds lighter than he ended last year to start camp. And when you look at the course of a long season, he admitted he got tired. He hit, I think it was around 155 from September on to the end of the regular season. So he's a guy who fatigued, and it certainly showed up. He gave the club some of their better at-bats against Tanaka and some tough pitchers, but he really struggled through certain parts of the season. And I think as a young player, you often hear about how they're just not ready simply for the 162-game season. I think Jonathan Scope was in that category. I think he'll be better prepared this year. Spring training last year, he was trying to make the team. He was more in mid-season form. I would expect him to kind of keep the reins on a little bit more in camp. This club has seen what he can do. They've seen what he's about. So perhaps, you know, he eases into it a little bit more. But I think he's fully capable of being their everyday guy again. If he can just limit kind of those peaks and valleys that he had last year. There were stretches where it was really tough to put him in the lineup even when his defense was good because he simply wasn't giving them good at-bats. I think if he really focuses on making that strike zone a little bit smaller, being more selective, he's got a lot of power. He's a young kid, just turned 23 years old. So if he can really rein that in, he could have some serious potential to be a power hitter in the big leagues.
And then one last thing. It seems that we finally got some resolution, at least for the time being, on this ongoing story of Dan Duquette and the possibility of him going to Toronto. Where is the organization kind of stand and the front office kind of stand now that this apparently at least had some reality to it, but he's sticking around and it seems to be over, again, at least for now?
Yeah, you kind of hit on it, at least for now. It's interesting because does this problem go away or is it delayed a year because the Blue Jays announced that CEO Paul Beeston is staying for the 2015 season? Now, when Dan Duquette was asked this weekend whether this was gone for good, he sidestepped the question. So, of course, you start to wonder, is this really gone away? Probably not. Now, in terms of this year, how much of a disruption was it and whatnot, I don't think a whole lot. There obviously was truth to it. Dan Duquette admitted finally this weekend that there was truth to it. and kept reiterating that the Orioles have been in focus this winter. And I do believe that, mostly, because when you look at offseason's past, he's never been a guy who's made all these flashy moves. So fans saying that the Orioles haven't done anything because Dan Duquette wasn't fully concentrated, you're just really not doing your homework and looking at what he's done and the kind of moves he's made since he got here. So this club will continue to make those, you know, smaller moves, those low-risk moves, the under-the-radar type of signings. And I do believe that Dan Duquette is focused on the Orioles at least for this season, but it's certainly something to keep on the back burner and keep an eye on because, like I said, once 2015 ends, do we deal with this whole thing again? There was flat fire to it before. I imagine there will be again, especially when you look at what's going to happen to Beeston after the 2015 season.
All right. Well, Brittany DiRolli, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking New York Yankees with MLB.com's Yankees beat reporter, Brian Hoke. Brian, it's February, and there is an unsigned significant free agent, which means that the Yankees are being mentioned with said unsigned significant free agent. What's your understanding of, and I know it's about the fourth time we've talked about this, of the Yankees and James Shields and whether that's viable in any way?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Matthew, it seems like we go over the same ground every week, but you're right. As long as there's a guy out there who could help this team improve their chances of winning the AL East, I think people are going to connect them to it. And obviously Shields would improve a team that right now, you know, depending on who you talk to, they look like an 84 to 85 win team, which, you know, is competitive, but Hal Steinbrenner keeps saying postseason caliber and championship caliber. And I'm not sure that 84, 85 wins get you there. That being said, they have a lot of money coming back on the books. As we've talked about before, Alex Rodriguez is a big part of that. They're bumping right up against $210 million right now. And, you know, you talk to people in the organization, they said they were going to be out on John Lester. We said, all right, we'll see. Prove it. They did. They said they were going to be out on Max Scherzer. Prove it. They did. Now here we are with James Shields. And you're still saying prove it, but they weren't bluffing the first two times. And that tells me if you had a chance to get Scherzer or Lester and didn't do anything with it, I'm not sure why then you'd go after James Shields.
And that kind of leads me into my next question. I'd be curious, and I obviously the Yankees aren't going to give this away. You know, they're not going to tell you exactly how they assess players that aren't their own. But I do wonder how they view him. And to me, Shields is kind of a Rorschach test anyway. I mean, you can kind of see what you want to see. I think there are people who still view him as a one. I don't think it's unreasonable to think he's not even a two on a championship team, that maybe he's a three on a championship team. How would they do they view him as a difference maker or an innings guy?
I think it's probably a combination of the two, but I think if you're going to go after James Shields and try to sell him as a true ace, I'm not sure I would buy that. Look, they've already got nine-figure pitching contracts out there to Masahiro Tanaka and CeCe Sabathia. Obviously, you've probably seen the best of Sabathia, and you know that any one pitch could be Tanaka's last for 12 to 18 months, and obviously they're going into the year hoping that Tommy John doesn't have to happen, but they know it's a possibility. Anyway, the point is they've already committed a huge amount of money there to the rotation. I think to give out another big deal to get a guy like Shields, even if his price has come down a little bit, I think at this stage of the offseason that may be too much to ask.
And there is actually one other intriguing free agent that just became a free agent within the last day or so, and that's Yoan Moncada. Is that a guy that the Yankees might be in on?
Yeah, I mean, yes. Short answer, yes. They're in on Moncada. I think that everybody around the game has been waiting to see how this is all going to shape out. But, you know, and we're coming in off this where I was just saying how it doesn't look like they're going to spend money on Shields, but it's a little different with Moncada. And here's why. They went crazy last year on the international market. They spent about $15 million on guys. They're way over their limit. And what that's going to do is, essentially, they have to be in the penalty box for the next 2 years. They're not going to be able to give a guy these big bonuses. But Moncada is in play, and that's the kind of guy who, I mean, look, everybody says this guy is going to be a huge talent. He's only 19, but people are already saying he's a surefire big leaguer. He's going to get there, and he's going to make an impact. Okay. That's the kind of guy the Yankees need to put in their farm system, especially if he's not going to take too much development time. Look, the Yankee system has gotten better over the last couple of years. I know that everybody likes to say how the Yankees never develop their own prospects, and yeah, their opening day lineup this year, Brett Gardner's probably going to be the only homegrown guy. But I think this system is on the rise. They've committed to it, and obviously, look, Mark Newman on his way out the door last year, in the scouting department, they've put a lot of money into that pipeline, and I think that Moncada could be the cherry on top. There's going to be competition for him, but I would expect to see the Yankees in it to the very end on him.
Could you, because I'm not entirely sure even I understand, and it's my job, which means I'm sure that there are plenty of fans who don't entirely understand it. As far as the bonus pool, those regulations, the penalties, where do they stand as far as what they could do, how that impacts what they would do now? Is it a situation where, because this counts against last year, you essentially just go ahead and get killed for this past year and then worry about it next year? How does that all kind of shake down?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to get slammed on Moncada. In theory, let's say that it takes $40 million to sign this guy. They're going to pay 100% penalty on top of that. So now you're talking about $80 million to bring this guy into the pipeline. But here's the thing is, for the next 2 years after the deadline, they're not going to be able to spend any more than $300,000 on a bonus for any player. And obviously that's not going to get you a guy like Moncada, especially, I mean, I'm throwing out crazy numbers here. But we're talking $30 to $40 million to bring this guy in. So, you know, I think that it's the kind of guy that if the Yankees want to push all their chips in, they know already that they know what the future is going to hold. They know they have to cool their jets for the next 2 years. You might as well just go all in and finish it off here. And really has been a crazy signing period. And they're trying to take advantage of the way the system is set up.
Right, there's sort of there is this odd kind of setup where once you go in on a year, you may as well really go in on a year. I mean, is that sort of an accurate way to look at it?
Yeah, that's what I would say. I say, well, look, you're already over the line. You're in the penalty box. You know, to use a hockey analogy, you know, why not just get the 5 minutes for fighting on top of it?
Fair enough. And then you wrote last night, not really an analytical look, but touched on one of the big issues that I think a lot of people are wondering about as the 2015 Yankees start taking shape, and that is what they're going to do in the ninth inning. It seems like they've got about three options. I find it very hard to believe that Joe Girardi gets really creative and chooses option C and mixes and matches, but where do you think they are at as far as determining who pitches the ninth and how they deploy those two guys at the back of the bullpen?
Yeah, and obviously we're talking about Dellin Betances and Andrew Miller, and I'm not sure that there's really a wrong choice there. I think my gut tells me that Betances is going to be the closer in spring training, but Girardi's keeping an open mind. He wants to bring these guys into the spring, see how things are going to work out. And look, you never know who's going to get hurt, you know, which guy's going to have a nagging oblique or something late in camp. So I think it's smart for Joe not to lock in a closer right now. I mean, last year it took until January before somebody with the Yankees would finally say, yes, Dave Robertson is going to be the closer. So they're going to name a closer at some point. You don't have to have one on February 5 or whatever it is. I think that you go into camp, you see how the guys work out. But either way, what the Yankees like is Miller and Betances can both get lefties and righties out, as can a couple other guys in the back of that bullpen. But those are the two main guys I would look for, 8 and 9. And the one thing I would think about, and Betances talked a little bit about it this week, is one of his big strengths last year was that he was able to get multiple innings. He could get four or more outs, and he was dominant doing it. I mean, look at his stat line. But I think that if you're going to have a set closer, does that necessarily limit him to only the ninth inning? You want him to only come in for a clean ninth inning, or can you bring him in with two outs in the eighth or one out in the eighth? Maybe it doesn't wind up being a problem because you have a dominant guy to handle the eighth in Miller. But I think that no matter which way you go with it, Yankees, the back of the bullpen is going to be definitely one of their strengths this year. And what they're trying to do is replicate what you saw with Kansas City last year. And maybe they have a good shot at doing that.
This is almost certainly just me dreaming, but is there any chance they do something unconventional, even if it's as simple as having a closer who they're willing to go four or five outs with periodically? Or is it pretty much set in stone that whoever it is, one guy is going to be three outs in the ninth and one guy is not?
I think there's some freedom there. I think there's some wiggle room. And even last year, Girardi, especially toward the end of the year, would push Robertson and try to ask four or five outs from those guys. So I think that there's freedom there. I think it's just something in a situation where we're so used to how Mariano Rivera was handled. And really, look, he was an older closer. They wanted to try and save the bullets if they could. That didn't mean they wouldn't go to him for more in September and October. But for the most part, they were trying to limit Rivera to three outs. I feel like with Miller and Betances, you can ask a little bit more. And I expect that's what Girardi's going to do this year.
Well, Brian Hoke, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Toronto Blue Jays with MLB.com's Blue Jays beat reporter, Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, since the last time we talked, we appear to have gotten some kind of resolution on this front office question. Paul Beeston's going to be around for another year, then he's going to retire, and then we still don't know what goes on beyond that. To what extent was this a resolution, and to what extent does it just sort of delay the whole question for another year?
Well, I think what it does first and foremost is I think it gives Paul Beeston a proper departure. You know, I think, he's a guy who was a day one employee for this organization. He had a very successful run during his first go around, which was throughout the glory years of baseball in the city. And then he went away to the commissioner's office for a little while and eventually came back for a second go around. And since then, there's been a lot of productive things that he's been able to do as well. He's really kind of rebuilt the brand of Blue Jays baseball. So, you know, for all the work that he's done, for a little while, it looked like he was almost going to get thrown out in the cold a little bit. And that's just not something that someone with his kind of 10-year success and track record really deserves. So now he'll be back for the 2015 season. That's what he wanted all along. He's been saying for months and telling people for months that he was going to be back next year. Now it seems like he finally has the approval of ownership to actually go ahead and do that. So while he will retire at the end of the year, that's kind of been his plan. And now it looks like they can go forward together in this as opposed to what would look like it was going to be a pretty messy divorce for a little while.
Is it too soon to have any kind of read as to where this might go next year?
I think it is a little bit too early because I think there is obviously very clear interest in a couple of guys within the last few months, whether it was Kenny Williams in Chicago and obviously the more reported and the more serious one later on with Dan Duquette in Baltimore. So I wouldn't be surprised if eventually the Blue Jays look to kind of go with a baseball first kind of guy like that. Paul Beeston is a very, very knowledgeable baseball guy, but he specializes more on the business side of things. It almost looks like the new direction that Rogers would like to take with ownership is maybe bringing a president that's a little bit more focused on the actual baseball ops and then bring in a secondary person on top of that to help out with the business side of things. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see a baseball guy like a Kenny Williams or Dan Duquette at some point next year. But, I mean, it looks like for the most part this search has been put on completely on hold for at least a few months, and by the sounds of it, Paul Beeston is going to help in that process. So I'm sure there's going to be some drama at some point with all of this as names start to come out, but I think for the most part that's something you're not going to really hear about, at least until the season gets underway.
That sort of raises another interesting question to me and something I've been wondering a little bit about, which is whether it was Duquette before or whether it's somebody else that fits that profile in a year, it's very intriguing to me that a club with a general manager is looking to bring in a baseball guy to top to go into that position when that hasn't exactly been what they've doing. Is that in any way a reflection on the status of Alex Anthopoulos?
I think it is, and I think that's the way that you have to take it. I mean, Alex Anthopoulos is going into the last year of his deal as well. So there's going to be an awful lot of pressure. I think he's in a situation right now where he's going to have the team that he put together compete very strongly for a spot in the postseason this year. Probably has to make the postseason, at the very least has to come very, very close. Because you're right, if you bring in a guy who kind of focuses even more so on the actual product on the field, on the baseball side of things, if you bring in a former general manager to take over that presidency, well, a lot of times those guys are going to want to have final say. So that would really seem to undercut Anthopoulos' authority within the organization. That's not going to be an issue while Beeston is here. Those two get along very, very well. But it certainly does make you question what kind of future Alex has with the organization when you're having conversations with those type of people.
As for the 2015 actual baseball team, it seems like they are still in the hunt and still haven't really pulled the trigger on adding some relief help. Casey Jansen officially left. It seemed like they were close on something with Ronald Belisario, and that fell through. Where are they right now as far as trying to deepen that bullpen? That seems to have been a goal for 3 months now.
Yeah, it really has. And it, you know, they're doing their due diligence in talking to pretty much everybody that's left out there, but those numbers seem to be dwindling by the week. You know, the Blue Jays have kind of been linked to, you know, whether it's guys like Phil Koch, or, you know, you still hear those rumors about Francisco Rodriguez or Rafael Soriano. And I think the Blue Jays are going to need to have to get a very nice deal in order to actually go through with any signings. Salary is obviously a concern. You know, when they were looking at Belisario, it was going to be on a minor league deal. I think they would love to bring in guys like that to come in and compete for roles. But this team clearly needs another legitimate arm down there. The longer this goes on, the more it makes you think that they are eventually going to be forced into using Aaron Sanchez at the back end of that bullpen, because they're simply not going to have any other choice. They just don't have enough reliable options on there to do anything else. I still think they're going to bring in at least one guy, but I really think that they're hoping that the dollar drops on all those asking prices across the board.
Why has it gone this far? I mean, there's obviously been some really big reliever deals at the top end. Some guys have definitely gotten paid, but it doesn't seem to have been overall particularly kind of overheated market for free agent relievers. And with it being such an obvious priority, why have they not been able to get something done before now?
It's a great question. I think it's one that, you know, a lot of people are struggling to answer up here right now. It does seem that they have a limited amount, and I think that they've been trying to do multiple things with that $5 million or so that they have left to spend. So as opposed to spending it on one guy and then not having much besides minor league deals possible after that, I think they've been almost trying to spread it around. And I still think that they're hoping that, you know, the prices go down enough where they might be able to add at least, you know, one legitimate guy for the amount of money that they have available. And certainly, you know, those asking prices for guys have been starting to come down. I mean, take Casey Jansen as a perfect example of that. I mean, here's a guy who looked like he was on his way to having a relatively decent payday. And while he got a nice spot in Washington, he didn't end up with the kind of money that he eventually thought he was going to get. So I think the Blue Jays will be looking for something similar like that on a one-year deal, relatively low risk. But, I mean, time is running out, so you can only wait around for so long on some of these guys before you really kind of have to either just go ahead with the deal or move on with what you've got.
Is it interesting to you at all that a club in this position where they are right in the middle of their window and potentially nearing the end of not their chance for contention, but this window with this current group that they spent a lot of money to put together, and apparently some pressure on the front office to some extent, and yet they seem to be sticking to a really hard line as far as the total payroll. Is that as interesting to you as it is to me, that there doesn't seem to be any flexibility as far as if a guy turns an 87-win team into an 89-win team or whatever it may be? Just seems like there's enormous value to marginal wins with this club right now, where they really may be in a place where a win or two is the difference between a first playoff appearance in a long time and not having that.
Absolutely. And my opinion on this goes back, you know, all the way to last year as well. I'm a believer that you've really got to protect your investment on that as well. And I mean, this is, you can't criticize the overall payroll that the Blue Jays have had for the last few years. They've been very competitive with that, but it seems like they haven't gone to the next step. You know, 3 years ago, it didn't work out after the Miami trade quite the way that they thought it would, but a lot of that core was still in place. And last year, it seemed like there was an ability to, you know, get past the injuries of the year before and add to that core and really take the next step. Well, all the Blue Jays were able to do last year was add Gianna Navarro. So, you know, they were still missing that, you know, front-line starting pitcher that it looked like they really needed. This year, the offseason was completely opposite to a certain extent, in that they started off so aggressive and did so many things early on throughout the month of November that I think it had fans up here almost giddy at what was going on. But again, it was almost like they went halfway but didn't quite put the finishing pieces in touch. And you look at that team right now, I mean, the Blue Jays, if they added, if they were in the market for an elite starting pitcher, then you could have a lot. You could move Aaron Sanchez to the bullpen without nearly as many concerns, or you could add, a very strong piece or two to the bullpen, and then that would allow you to make Sanchez your number five guy and really kind of go forward with that. There was multiple options that they had to kind of really round out this roster. Right now, they haven't done it, so there's still a lot of question marks. And while this team could compete in the American League East, it's certainly no foregone conclusion. And I think, it would have gotten a lot easier if they would have been able to make just a couple of these other moves. And it's not, you know, they're not blockbuster moves necessarily, but even just kind of finishing off with those finishing pieces. And so far, that's something that they haven't done.
All right. Well, Gregor Chisholm, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Tampa Bay Rays with MLB.com's Rays beat reporter, Bill Chastain. Bill, unsurprisingly, the Rays keep tinkering around the edges and making little moves. Their latest, bringing in Ronald Belisario and Alexi Casilla. These seem like they're not big name moves, but for a team that might have some openings in those spots, potentially interesting. Does anything stand out about their most recent round of little moves as far as guys to maybe keep an eye on?
Well, I would definitely say that, Belisario fits the mold of what they've done in recent years. They've always seemed to bring in a couple of, veteran relievers that they signed the minor league deals with an invite to spring. And they've had a really good track record from Joel Peralta to Joaquin Benoit, Juan Cruz, a bunch of guys they've brought in like that and have done well. So I would say he's got a decent shot based on just past history and then how they also play some of their guys on their roster with, options left where they can leave them in the minor leagues for another year. But, you know, they always look at this thing as like going into the season as like they look at it as really a 40-man roster for the season. And, you know, it's funny how many times you'll look at what the starting lineup was and who the 25-man roster was at the start of the season. And you look at it in August and you say, wow, I forgot those guys were even starting the season with them. So there really is a lot of truth to that. It's not just a line of bull when you're, you know, telling your players, you know, we need all of you guys, you know, from number 35 up to 40. So I think right now they're really just kind of cranking up the depth.
One name that is very intriguing that is still out there and kind of can't help wondering, it will be an interesting fit. Yoan Moncada has been linked at least somewhat to the Rays. Do you think there's a potential fit there? Do you think that's something they could make happen?
Well, of course, he did come in to work out with the team, and I think it would just come down to totally a money issue with them, as a lot of things do with the Rays. But, you know, certainly they seem to always go on the side of youth, and this guy does look like quite a prospect. But they have done a nice, you know, job during this offseason of kind of restocking the cupboard as well. So, I think it's just going to come down to what the asking price and, you know, what this kid's going to be able to get.
Do you see them as being more willing to get into the bidding, and you kind of touched on this, on a player like this where, one, you're not talking about eight or nine figures, and two, where you're talking about a guy that you will have through his development and presumably into his prime rather than buy in post-prime. Do you see them more inclined to maybe not go crazy, but bid seriously on a guy like that than on your traditional free agent?
Yeah, and I think it makes a lot more sense than, you know, just like, you know, in comparison to, say, like some of the Japanese free agents that come over and you have the big fee you have to pay before you can even get in the ballgame. But, I think, and then the Rays never really come out and quite say this, but, you know, I think you're always looking at the one side of a player's career with the Rays as opposed to the other side, which is the big money-making side. And there's a lot of advantages on being on the side that the Rays are on, and primarily that's youth. And, you know, I think if they are going to take a gamble, you know, the guy might be a good gamble for them. Not that he's a gamble. I mean, because he sounds like he's a real talent, but I just meant as far as investing the money.
Yeah. There's been some movement maybe with a real key guy for this club. It sounds like Matt Moore is coming along. I know you haven't had a whole lot of chance to actually see him and see what he's doing, but the sounds are positive. What's your understanding on where things stand with Matt Moore?
I did see him several weeks ago, and he said he had had – now, I didn't see him throw off the mound last week, but he did tell me that he has not had any setbacks, and he feels really good. And, you know, Joe Maddon used to say that, you know, you could tell how a player is coming along just by his facial language, and if that ever were the, if that were true, you know, you would say Matt Moore is a lock to be back maybe even ahead of time. But one thing from watching these kind of injuries over the years, and even watching with Hellickson last year, who had just a minor cleanup on his elbow, it's like these guys will come back and feel well, but it takes a little bit before you can really, you know, that fine line of what makes a major league pitcher and not a major league pitcher, you know, particularly where control is, seems to be the hardest thing to get back. And sometimes it goes a little bit longer even than when they come back.
Well, it seems to me, and tell me if you disagree, that a rehabbing guy is the best possible example of the difference between control and command. You can have a guy who's able to throw strikes, but it's that fine bit of location that is the last thing that comes, where sure, you're in the zone, but what really makes the elite is where in the zone are you.
Totally, totally. That's totally what, you know, it's, you know, you can throw strikes all day long, but it's putting it in the strike zone where you want to put it in the strike zone, and you know, how quick that comes will determine how key of a contributor he is to this year's team.
We're still looking at a mid-season kind of thing for him, aren't we? I mean, we're not talking about a guy who might be in the first couple of months.
No. I mean, they're talking, when they say late June, early July, I would think more, you know, mid to late July, just because, you know, it's always better to err on the side of caution on these kind of things. So unless he's really just, way above, you know, ahead of things, I would be very surprised if it weren't mid to late July. And that's just me guessing. That's nothing official.
Sure.
The club has said.
What do you think is still out there for this club to do? I mean, I don't think anybody expects any kind of big splash, but I also, you know, watching this club, you know better than I do, that they're almost never really done. So what kind of adjustments do you think are still out there for them to make around the margins to try and improve this club between now and opening day?
Well, obviously they'll probably keep their eyes out for, you know, something to kind of enhance their catching, because other than Rene Rivera, who they got in the Will Myers deal with San Diego, they've got Kurt Casale coming back, who played well for them last year, and then they've also got non-rostered by the Bobby Wilson. So I'm sure they'll keep their eyes open, and you know, probably anything they could get at this time would probably be mostly a defensive-minded catcher. I don't think we're looking at Jaso as catching much at all based on his concussion stuff. And even though when the trade was made for Jaso, they did say, you know, he was healthy, I think there's still some concern there. You know, and we'll have to see how that plays out. But that's really the only – and I would also look maybe – you know, I think probably DeJesus is still in play, but – I say that, and I also look at the outfield, and there's a lot of, you know, balls in the air for guys coming back and doing well and whatnot. You know, Desmond Jennings coming back from a little knee thing. And, you know, if Steven Souza is what they think he is. So, you know, there's worse things, talking to some Rays officials, there's worse things than having David DeJesus, you know, as your leadoff hitter against right-handed pitching.
And the other spot that kind of looks interesting to me is the middle infield, where you've got a variety of pieces that seem like they could go either side of the diamond. If you had to project right now what how the kind of primary distribution of playing time goes down in the middle infield, how do you think that looks?
Well, I think you probably see a platoon with Forsythe and Franklin at second. Who knows? You know, and the wild card in there has got to be Tim Beckham. I referred to seeing Matt Moore a couple of weeks ago. I actually saw Tim Beckham at that workout as well, and he just had a glow about him. He looked like he's totally over his knee issue. Of course, he could play shortstop as well. So I think if you want to look maybe at a good long shot bet, he might be the guy that gets in there. And, you know, he can run as well. So, but I agree with you. The middle infield is probably, I wouldn't say the weakest link, but probably the most unsure link going into the season.
All right. Well, Bill Chastain, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Boston Red Sox with MLB.com's Red Sox beat reporter, Ian Brown. In the until and unless the Red Sox sign somebody who is by acclamation or acquire somebody who is by acclamation a number one starter, the topic will remain. We had a column on your site fairly recently about that, something that won't go away. And now there seems to be a new round of Cole Hamels rumors. What's your understanding as far as where the Red Sox stand with any kind of possibility of acquiring Hamels right now?
Yeah, Matthew, I think there's a lot more urgency from outside the Red Sox organization, whether it's fans or media, you know, or other teams who might want to engage the Red Sox in talks for them to get at Cole Hamels. I think the Red Sox kind of know what the price is right now, and they're happy with what they have, and they think that they can go to battle with this rotation. I think Ben Cherington is quietly optimistic with the rotation he has. It doesn't have that true number one, but I think the Red Sox are of the belief that not every team needs a true number one starter. You can kind of, if you have five guys who can do the job, maybe I think you can at least get through to the trading deadline, you know, without that quintessential number one on paper. And I think that's what they're trying to do. And they also look at, hey, who last year at this time thought Corey Kluber was an ace and was going to win a Cy Young Award? Sometimes an ace develops who, you know, might not look like an ace going into a season. So I think the Red Sox also think that's possible. But right now, as long as the Phillies are looking for a Blake Swihart or a Mookie Betts, I think the Red Sox are all set on Cole Hamels.
It did seem, and you know, you follow this closer than I do, which is why I ask you this, it does seem that the reports seem to suggest that one way or another, perhaps the Phillies were softening a little or that their asking price had come down or adjusted. Do you get that impression or is that not the case?
No, not the impression I've got. I mean, I'm sure if the Phillies are that motivated to get rid of Hamels, you know, I'm sure that you know their price will come down at some point. The question is, you know, can they make a trade with the Red Sox that won't involve Swihart or Betts? Because I think the Red Sox are pretty adamant that these are two key guys for them. When you look at the middle of the field for the next few years, so they don't want to go there. So if they could get down to Bradley and then you know some major league talent, whether it's an Alan Craig or some other guys, you know, they could be creative in putting it together a package like that. Then it gets realistic. But from what I've heard, it still seems like the Phillies are looking for Swihart at the very least. And as long as that's the case, it's just not going to match up.
If they've got Vasquez, why is that such a sticking point?
Well, I think that they like Vasquez a lot, but I think they really look at Swihart and can be somebody special with his bat and with the different things he can do offensively and defensively. I think the jury is still very much out on Vasquez, you know, what kind of hitter he's going to be. Defensively, there's no question he can be a difference maker. But, you know, Swihart's got a real nice left-handed bat that they're really high on, and I think they're just really leery of letting him go. So, you know, I think and they also – it's also a tricky one because you could say, oh, why don't they just trade Vasquez? Well, the Red Sox feel that Christian Vasquez for 2015 is their best catcher, and the Swihart's not quite ready. So catching depth is a thing that a lot of teams don't have. So I don't think the Red Sox necessarily want to compromise that right now until they see exactly how it's going to sort itself out, exactly how you know, what kind of players Swihart and Vasquez can both be in the major leagues.
The other name that's out there, and he's for my money, certainly not on a level with Cole Hamels or some of these guys we consider one, but James Shields is still out there. You know, he's probably a legit two on a good staff. Is he a viable possibility for them at all, or is that really kind of a non-starter?
Yeah, I don't think he's a possibility, Matt. The Red Sox talked to James Shields back at the winter meetings, had sort of an introductory conversation with him, and talks didn't really progress much from there. And you look at Shields' numbers lifetime at Fenway Park, they're pretty bad. You know, he has just never pitched well in that ballpark. So I think that, you know, Shields is kind of, you know, I think what the Red Sox look at is Shields is, you know, he's kind of a big name, but I think the Red Sox feel that a guy like Rick Porcello might be able to pitch better than Shields this year for a lot less money. And, you know, you also look at Clay Buchholz. They look at Clay Buchholz as somebody who, you know, if he could ever stay healthy and stop being a tease, you know, he's somebody who could equal or better what James Shields has done. So my sense is, unless the Red Sox have really been covering this well, I just don't think that they're all that high on James Shields. I don't see him coming to Boston.
They have done a little bit of adjustment around the margins of the roster, particularly in the bullpen here recently. I thought Alexi Ogando was an interesting acquisition. What do they expect from Ogando? What do they think he can offer?
Yeah, they're really hoping that he can help in that seventh, eighth inning role to help set up Koji. I mean, this is a guy, Ogando, who before he developed some arm problems last year, this guy's a pretty effective reliever. So I think what the Red Sox have done, and they did this a couple of years ago too, is they're just acquiring as many good relief pitchers as they can. You know, knowing that there's always attrition in the bullpen, knowing that there's always, you know, unpredictable performance of the bullpen. You know, you look at when they got Koji 2 years ago, you know, they were just looking at him. People didn't even really know how he fit at the time. You know, he wound up becoming the closer. So I think it's just, like I said, Ben Cherington just trying to get as many options as he can, viable options for manager John Farrell in the bullpen, and Ogando certainly gives them another guy when he's right. You know, he's a very good pitcher.
And then another sort of seemingly minor, but to me interesting move was the trade for Robbie Ross. They parted with a guy in Renato who not that long ago seemed like a pretty big part of their future. What was the thought process behind that move?
Yeah, Matthew, I was a little surprised about the Renato Ross trade too, just because, like I said, last year at this time we were looking at Renato along with Barnes and Owens and some of their other pitchers as some of their better pitchers in their farm system. Now Renato did pitch in the major leagues a little bit last year and gave up a lot of home runs. So I don't know whether they just saw some fatal flaw and whether they just saw that he was never going to get much better than what he does, than what he did last year, or whether they're just really excited about what Robbie Ross can do. And I think that they think Ross, in the bullpen, they think that he could carve out a real niche. And you look, the Red Sox have never quite replaced Andrew Miller as a lefty in that bullpen ever since they got rid of him last July, and then he signed with the Yankees this winter. So still trying to get some effectiveness from the left side, and they think that maybe there's some untapped potential there with Ross where he could really excel as a full-time reliever.
Are they set in the bullpen now, or is there still more tweaking there to be done?
I would think, just looking at it on paper, that they have a lot of guys now, and there's already a competition there for several spots. So I think that they're by and large, they're done in the bullpen right now, and you're going to see how all these pieces fit together in camp. You're going to see who's going to be the main lefty coming out of the bullpen, whether it's Ross or whether it's Breslow or whether it's Tommy Lane, the guy who pitched pretty well last year, and then Cody's your closer as long as he's healthy, and then how does that set up with Tozawa and Ogando and some of the other guys they got this winter. So Red Sox feel good about their bullpen, I think, because they have a lot of options. It's just a matter of seeing how John Farrell can best put it all together in camp.
And then the last remaining big name out there is Yoan Moncada. Last aside from Shields. Is he a guy that the Red Sox could be a player on? It's kind of hard. When you're the Red Sox, it's pretty much always the name. It's going to be asked. So do you think that get involved in that, or do you think they sit that out?
Yeah, I mean, they did look at him, they were one of the teams that had a private workout for him. But the Red Sox just made a pretty big expenditure in Ruzne Castillo last summer. And, Mercado is an interesting guy, but he's an up-the-middle player, and they have Pedroia, and they have probably Xander Bogaerts for the foreseeable future. So I'm just not sure, quite sure the Red Sox are going to put together quite the financial package that another team might, like the Yankees or the Dodgers or, some of the other teams that you've heard. But, I'm quite certain that the Red Sox are going to make an offer, but I don't get the sense that they're all in on this guy and that they're willing to go top dollar, because I think that they have some players at the positions he's best at.
Gotcha. All right. Well, Ian Brown, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks everybody for listening.
Visit the official online shop of Major League Baseball at MLB.com/shop for the largest selection of authentic caps, T-shirts, jerseys, hoodies, collectibles, and more. Get your gear straight from the source, the MLB.com shop.